Friday this evening. The speaker is Paul Clark. Paul received an MA in experimental psychology from the University of Cambridge and a PhD in behavioral neuroscience from University of London's Institute of Psychiatry. He did postdocs at the National Institute of Mental Health in Bethesda, USA, and at UBC in neurological sciences. He's currently professor in the Department of Pharmacology and Therapeutics at McGill University. Dr. Clark contributed to the groundbreaking 1988 U.S. Surgeon General's report, which identified nicotine addiction as a consequence of cigarette smoking. More recently, he's contributed to smoking-related reports of the Royal Society of Canada and Royal College of Physicians in the UK. His research is mainly focused on brain mechanisms underlying dependence on drugs and tobacco. This work, which is conducted mostly in rats, has provided information about the anatomical localization of brain nicotinic receptors, particularly in relation to mesolimbic dopamine neurons, the role of these neurons in arousing and rewarding effects of nicotine, the discovery of a compound that blocks brain nicotinic receptors in a quasi-permanent manner, and the finding that rewarding and arousing effects of psychomotor stimulants and nicotine are anatomically segregated in the brain. This year, he received the Principal's Prize for Excellence in Teaching. So aside from being an award-winning, groundbreaking researcher, his students like to listen to him, talk about what he does and what he loves to do and learn about. I asked him to give a talk tonight. I thought he was going to give his usual talk where he focuses on nicotine or cocaine addiction and how the brain functions under those stimulations. He was the one who suggested this. He said, I really want to dispel some myths or clarify some misunderstandings about what it's like to work with rats. I want to tell people about conversations I've had with rats. And in consultation with Paul, we've chosen the film that we'll show after his presentation. This is a 1968 film. Cliff Robertson, the main actor, won the Academy Award for it. It was based on a novel called Flowers for Algernon, required reading for most Canadian high school children. Charlie is a man who has mental challenges. He's given a drug that helps him stimulate his brain. He becomes much more intelligent, but then, and also he befriends the lab rat, Charlie, or Algernon in the novel. We'll show that after the presentation. You're not obliged to stay. Paul says his presentation is not entirely new, but it will be partly based on the work he's done in rats over the past few years. There'll be a Q&A after Paul's presentation. Because it's being videotaped for presentation on McGill webcast, and on Canal Savoir, that's our local area, it's kind of like our little Discovery Channel. Please don't head down the stairs during the Q&A. If you do have to leave this room, I've opened the door at the back. That'll take you down the emergency staircase to a door that says, don't push this, it's an emergency exit. All right, nothing will happen. You can exit that way. You'll be right beside our building and the Leacock building. Okay? So Paul's going to start with his talk, Conversations with Brains. Enjoy.
Thank you very much, Ingrid. That was great. Far too long an introduction, but thank you. So, this is not my main research interest, but it's something that's becoming more interesting, I think, as time goes on. And I rather cheekily called the title of this talk Conversations with Rats. It really should be more like eavesdropping on rats, or monologues that I have listened to from rats, or my students, in fact, have listened to more than I. But you all know, I'm sure, that a variety of species make ultrasonic calls of some sort or other, for different purposes, and there are many different creative ways that animals use ultrasound. The first suggestion that rodents might use ultrasound, we go back more than 100 years. There was a letter in Nature where a man wrote in to the editor to say, I'm on holiday somewhere, I think it was a few kilometers from Nice, with his young son. There was a mouse that became tame, living in the hotel room with them, and it would start singing in the evening and would sometimes sing for a long time. And the son had the bright idea that maybe animals of this sort were capable of producing sounds beyond our hearing range, beyond the frequency range. And I think it's a lovely letter. I wish it was that easy to get letters in nature, but unfortunately it's not. So what do we mean by ultrasound? Usually we say that humans can hear up to roughly 20,000 hertz, 20 kilohertz. Of course, it's a bit of a fuzzy number that, you know, older people like me tend to have a bit of a drop-off in the high-frequency range with age. There's natural variability, but let's say 20. So everything above 20 kilohertz is considered ultrasound. Now, that's humans, but of course there's another species related to humans called adolescents, and they have a slightly higher sensitivity, hence this new device called the mosquito, which you've probably heard about, which apparently could be heard by them, but not by adults. And so can be used for useful purposes. Don't know if it works. Rats can hear quite a bit beyond our own hearing range, up to about 90 kilohertz, in fact. And not only can they hear in that range, but they also make calls in that range as well. And the calls are really of two main types. There are the 22 kilohertz calls, so that would be calls that are just beyond our hearing range, and then what are known as 50 kilohertz calls, which is really, as you will see, a rag bag of many different calls, roughly at 50 kilohertz. Now, let's talk briefly about these 22 kilohertz calls. Rats will make 22 kilohertz calls, for example, when they're startled. This is a showing you a picture of a rat, all taken within, I think, about a tenth of a second. Very rapid response to a sudden, very loud sound. A rat that hears a sound previously associated with electric shock will also make these 22 kilohertz calls. And rats, as you probably know, have a natural fear of cats. And in the presence of a cat, a rat will make the 22 kilohertz call. So what are these 22 kilohertz calls? Well, a bit more on them first. If now, this there are two reasons why this rat here would not call when confronted by a cat. First of all, it's a mouse. You spotted that, I'm sure. And also, because rats tend to make these calls, it's been reported, when they feel safe. So a rat out in the open may not make these 22 kilohertz calls, wait till it gets in the burrow when it's feeling safe. So that was 22 kilohertz calls. 50 kilohertz calls, I think, are much more varied and interesting. And that's really what we study in the lab. Our rats rarely have ever made 22 kilohertz calls during normal testing. So when does a rat make a 50 kilohertz call? Well, it's been reported that rats will make quite a lot of these calls when they're playing together. Particularly adolescent rats love to play. It's reported that if you feed rats once a day, that's something that they will get used to, taking their entire daily intake in an hour, say. If you feed them once a day, then they will make calls in anticipation. They also make calls in anticipation of other good things if they're expecting visitors, especially a male rat who's anticipating female company. Actually, one of the most potent stimuli for eliciting these 50 kilohertz calls in rats is in male rats is the pheromones produced by females when they're in estrus. Excuse me, that would be female rats, by the way. So if we put it all together, then, and we ask, what are the stimuli that produce 22 kilohertz calls, and what are the stimuli or contexts that produce 50 kilohertz calls? It really breaks down relatively simply, with some prominent exceptions, I think, into 22 kilohertz seem to be alarm or distress calls. I think that's pretty clear. 50 kilohertz calls are proposed, as you will see, to be some sort of measure of pleasure or hedonia, some marker of positive mood, as far as we can tell what that would be in a rat. Now, Jack Panksepp, who's been a pioneer in this field and has produced a lot of interesting work, has proposed, as you may know, that these 50 kilohertz calls in rats are actually an antecedent of human laughter. So let's hear him say that. This is freely available on YouTube, by the way, if you're interested.
As we have listened to animals playing, we have heard what appeared to be the sounds of laughter. And we studied these for a couple of years without quite understanding that this might be laughter. And then one day we decided to tickle some animals. then we realized that we had to look at the sounds at a very different register than we can hear. So we obtained these transducers that are called batch detectors that can bring very high frequencies down to our auditory range. And when we did this and we listened in, we could tickle animals and generate a lot of vocal activity that appeared to be laughter. These animals would begin to enjoy our company, and they would start to play with our hands, and wherever we would put our hands, they would follow it. And when we tested these animals to ask whether they were enjoying this kind of activity, the unambiguous answer was yes.
So, I've watched that video so many times. It's one of my personal favorites. Anyway, you're free to watch it on YouTube. So, so that would be the strong hypothesis, that these 50 kilohertz calls really are something akin to laughter in humans. We seem to be stuck here. Oh. Yes. Now, this approach... The belief that one can actually study emotion in animals is something that's really counter to much of behavioral work. You probably know about the movement promoted by B.F. Skinner, where the idea was that we couldn't really ever know about the emotions of animals, but we could certainly study their behavior. And so if you're studying motivated behavior, for example, rats learning to press levers in boxes for food or drugs, it tells you something very important. It's about motivated behavior. It's not necessarily telling you much directly about emotion, how the animal is feeling at the time. So I'll tell you now how we used to measure ultrasonic vocalizations in rats. And this would be with a cheap and cheerful bat detector. And this we don't use anymore. It's cheap and it's a little crude, but it does at least reveal to you the sorts of sounds that make ultrasound. So the world in the ultrasound register is very different. So keys are a very good one. If anybody has some candy wrappers, we could try that. There are certain kinds of lab coat made of some synthetic material that make a lot of ultrasound and would perhaps be quite bothering for the animals, so we use cotton lab coats. So there's a whole different world once you get into the ultrasonic register, and you can tap into it with something that costs $300, but you can't get very far. What you need to do is buy one of these very nice pieces of equipment, which will give you much more information about the calls with greater sensitivity. So that's how we're equipped now. We have microphones that cost more than $1,000 each because they have to be very well calibrated in the ultrasonic range. So essentially, the microphone takes in the information, and then the first step would be an intensity, in other words, loudness on the y-axis, time on the x-axis, something like that. And that is then automatically transformed with Fourier analysis. So what we get is a spectrogram, which is frequency, usually in kilohertz, against time that way. So here are two separate calls. These calls tend to be rather brief. The typical call length might be 30 milliseconds, about a 30th of a second, in other words. And the frequency here, although not shown, would be about 50 kilohertz. Okay, now, just a little bit more, in case you want to ever develop a new hobby. If you using the software, this is intensity against time, now turned by Fourier analysis into a rather noisy trace. But what you can discern, oh, it's getting cleaner now, what you can discern are these calls. And we have to manually, we being my students, have to manually tag each call by clicking left and right on each call. And if I tell you that rats can make up to 3 calls per second, you can see that you can generate a lot of calls in one recording session, and it can be a work really of like a monastic, a monk from the Middle Ages to do this sort of thing. And then we can select different parameters that we're interested in, such as the length of the call, the frequency, and out it comes in a spreadsheet and so forth. So that the purpose of showing you that is just to show you how tedious research can be. And this is the time really to acknowledge the people who've done the work that I'm going to be showing today. Jen Wright, probably did most of the work that I'm going to show you. She's just finishing her PhD, and then Tina Scardocchio and Hiromi. with some other collaborators there and people who worked in the lab as well. So my interest in ultrasonic vocalizations really came from my interest in drug addiction and what is the relationship between motivation, or if you like, the compulsion to take drugs, and the subjective effects that you get from drugs. Are the brain mechanisms similar, overlapping, the same, and so forth? And this really, my focus is the neurotransmitter dopamine. Now, a drug that releases a lot of dopamine in the brain, and it certainly is very reinforcing, is amphetamine. And of course, it produces euphoria in a lot of humans as well. It's a great way to generate calls. Inject a rat with amphetamine in a reasonable dose, and they make many more calls. And our first big project was to find out what kind of calls they made when injected with amphetamine, either when they were tested singly or with their cage mate. And what we found was that there were a lot of calls. Now, I'm going to play you rat calls slowed down so that it's within your own frequency range, so you can hear it. And I want you to tell me, what does this sound like to you? Sounds very much like birdsong, does it not? And that is because it was birdsong. Now I'm going to play you the sound of a rat. Now you're not going to believe me about anything. All right. So these calls, obviously, have been transformed. The frequency has been shifted downwards so that they're within your own range. And maybe you want to do it again and see if you can follow the calls. Maybe I'll point them out to you as they go. Trill. Longer trill. The mouse is not working for me. Okay, so I think you can see that they're pretty heterogeneous, they're pretty diverse. And if you look at it, this would be a very active rat in almost real time. You get an idea of how many different kinds of calls there might be. Now, an early question we had is this a spectrum or is there some order here? Are there distinct subtypes of calls or what's going on? Is it all random? Well, if you take enough of these calls and you look at them very carefully until you're practically cross-eyed, which is what Jen Wright did in my lab, then what you notice is that there are similarities. There are families. So we call them subtypes. So these are all 50 kilohertz calls, roughly at 50 kilohertz. But you can see that there are calls that are almost sinusoidal here. We call those trills. And we have some that are a constant frequency, which we call flat calls. And if it looks like that, you can't confuse it with any other subtype. These are distinct subtypes. I think there's no doubt about that. So we've identified 14 at least subtypes of call. And the question is this just the tip of the iceberg? Are there other call types yet to be discovered? I mean, it's pretty crude just giving rats amphetamine and looking. What about giving rats other interesting behavioral situations? Would they make other kinds of calls that have never been seen before? We don't know. There is a little bit of evidence in the literature that these calls have a communicative value, as you would expect. And this experiment here gives a hint of that. And this is just showing you that rats, when they're tested in pairs, call more frequently than rats that are tested, same rats tested singly. So this is calls per 4 minutes on a per rat basis. So in pairs, rats call more. Doesn't mean it's communicative, but it suggests it, I think. Now, the social context doesn't just affect the rate of calling, but it also affects the type of calls that these animals make. So when rats are tested singly, they tend to make quite a lot of flat calls. Those are those constant frequency calls that I showed you in the spectrogram previously. And they don't make too many of the trill calls typically. These are aggregated data. And we call this pie chart the call profile. Now, that was taken sort of average data from a number of singly tested animals. When tested in pairs, rats tend to make more trill calls and fewer of the flat. See that? The prevalence of trills has gone up. So what does that mean? We don't know, but it's, you start to realize that social context affects the type of calls they make. Amphetamine, as I mentioned, makes rats call more, decidedly so, and that is shown here, whether they're tested singly or in pairs. If you increase the dose of amphetamine, they make more and more calls. And that's not surprising, because amphetamine is speed. amphetamine makes you do a lot of things faster, makes rats do a lot of things faster. The more interesting thing, we think, is that amphetamine, like pair testing, makes them make more trills. So amphetamine changes the shape of the pie chart. So when animals get amphetamine, they make a greater proportion of trills at the expense of flat calls. So the shift in the pie chart under amphetamine is essentially similar to the shift that you get when you test animals in pairs. Now, a striking feature of 50 kilohertz calls is the enormous individual differences we see. This is just a group of 49 animals, all tested with the same dose of amphetamine, and the y-axis is showing you USVs. That stands for ultrasonic vocalizations. So the number of calls they make in this register per minute. So one rat here is making almost 2 calls per second. But quite a number of rats right down here, you can barely make out, are really on the x-axis, essentially mute. So why these individual differences, we're not sure, but we're very interested in them. You might say, well, how do you know that these are stable individual differences? Maybe the rat that called a lot today will call very little tomorrow. Well, we know that that's not true because we've repeatedly tested animals. And animals tend to keep their pecking order, as it were. A high caller is typically always a high caller, a low caller, always a low caller. Another way that rats differ in a stable manner is in the type of calls that they make. So rat B here made a high proportion of trills, but not many flats, whereas this rat over here actually made more flats than trills. And this is data collected over a number of sessions. So, and this is a consistent feature from one session to the next. So they have, rats seem to have some inbuilt, if you like, call personality. Another thing where rats differ one from the other is in the acoustic parameters of the calls. There are many ways to measure this, but the ones we're interested in are the duration of the call, the bandwidth, that's the difference between the maximum minimum frequency, and the average frequency. And I won't bore you with the details here, but rats do vary in a stable fashion, one from another, in all sorts of ways. So if you look at their trill calls, you'll find each bar here is a single animal. And so these rats were making quite wobbly trills with big diversions of frequency, whereas this rat here was making a much more of a ripply kind of trill. What does that mean? No idea, but it's interesting, I think. So we feel then that rats have their own personality, even though they've been somewhat inbred for many generations. And I would bet if a rat wasn't using olfaction, smell, it could probably identify other rats individually by the kind of calls, by their voice, by their utterances. Well, I've talked about amphetamine. A very similar drug is cocaine, of course, and both amphetamine and cocaine are euphoric in euphorigens in humans. So do they make the same kind of changes to ultrasonic vocalization? Well, here we gave the drugs intravenously, and what we were trying to do essentially was to see what the drugs did to 50 kilohertz calling as a potential model, perhaps, if these calls really reflect euphoria, of the human high, right? The high that you can get from psychostimulants. And amphetamine increased the call rate, not terribly dramatically over the course of about 10 minutes, you see there. Cocaine did something similar, but not quite to the same extent. More interestingly, perhaps, just as amphetamine preferentially increased the proportion of trill calls, so did cocaine. Different doses of cocaine, even quite a low dose of cocaine, increased the proportion of trills, squashed down the slice that is the flat calls. So, again, this seems to support the idea that 50 kilohertz calls might be a reflection of euphoria, and in particular, trill calls. But, there's a but. One but is that not all euphorigens promote trill calls. And so morphine, which is a pretty feel-good drug in humans, in our initial experiments, morphine actually inhibited the rate of calling and didn't seem to promote the trill calls at all. And that was a surprise to us. So we looked at this more formally by using a test called condition place preference. This is a commonly used test in behavioral neuroscience. And it depends on the fact that a rat will tend to return and spend time in a place where he was previously rewarded. And that reward could be food, if he's hungry, could be sex, if he's hungry, or it could be a drug like amphetamine or morphine. Morphine has been shown to be highly rewarding. So rats will definitely tend to spend a lot of time where they previously received morphine. And so the idea here is to have a box with two distinct compartments, and the animal is initially just given the free run of the apparatus on day one just to get used to it. And then on subsequent days, a given rat will be confined to one side under drug, and then the next day on the other side under saline as a control. And you do that a few times. So ultimately, the animal is going to make an association between the rewarding effect of the drug and the side where the drug was administered. Then on the test day, the door is open again. Now he has free run once again. And you ask the question, how long are you going to spend in each side of the compartment? Are you going to spend more time where you got the drug? So this is a way of just checking that morphine is rewarding, that was rewarding in the dose that we gave. The literature certainly suggested it would be. And we were interested to know then if morphine was indeed rewarding, would it increase the rate of calling or promote trill calls when it was given? In other words, during the conditioning phase, these days when the animals are getting the morphine. So that was the experiment. And a further thought we had was, because our initial experiments suggested that morphine actually suppresses the rate of calling, we wanted to rule out the possibility that morphine was simply sedating the animals. You know, in humans, a sufficient dose of morphine can be quite sedating. So we could look at that, because during the conditioning trials, that's when on half the days the animals were getting morphine, we were measuring the amount of locomotor activity, how much they were walking around, a crude measure of arousal, and we do that with the video recording. So to go to the end of the experiment first, on the final day, when we simply put him in the box, no drug present, where do you want to go? The rats clearly preferred the side where they previously got morphine. They spent about twice as much time on the morphine-associated side as on the saline-associated side. So that wasn't a big surprise, but it was just nice to confirm that morphine had been highly rewarding in our experiment. Then we went back to the conditioning trials, and we looked at 50 kilohertz calls, and we found again that when they first got morphine and the second time they got morphine, the animals reduced their rate of calling. So once again, morphine was suppressing these 50 kilohertz calls, not increasing them, even though during these conditioning trials, morphine was clearly rewarding. And they seemed to become tolerant to that effect, but overall, there was a suppressive effect of morphine. And then you could say, well, was that because they were sedated? Well, clearly not, because morphine did not reduce locomotor activity. It actually increased it mildly, but significantly. So, bottom line then, morphine in a standard dose that is typically rewarding in the literature is also rewarding in our hands. It's not sedating, and yet it suppresses these calls. And in addition, it showed there was absolutely no sign that morphine was promoting trill calls. Even the proportion of trill calls did not go up. So that suggests then that if these trill calls are a measure of euphoria, it's not the kind of euphoria you get from morphine. Or I should say, rats get from morphine. Well, what other things might make rats happy? I mean, given that we can't really know what a rat's feeling, but common sense might say, apart from amphetamine, if you have rats who are living together in a cage and you take one rat away overnight and then you reunite them, that should be fairly rewarding, you would think. And another thing that you saw in the movie from Jaak Panksepp is that tickling the animals induces calling as well. So then, we thought we'd compare these three conditions in the same animals, and sure enough, all of these manipulations increase the rate of 50 kilohertz calling, at least to some extent. Amphetamine increased it a lot, tickling tended to increase it a lot, social reunion, a bit. The more important thing for us was, what did these three manipulations do to the proportion of trills, right? If we know that amphetamine increases the proportion of trills, what about social reunion and what about play? Well, turns out there's the amphetamine increasing the proportion of trills. However, social reunion did not do that. And indeed, tickling actually reduced the proportion of trills, which was really unexpected. So what's going on here? Maybe trills is just a red herring, Or maybe we're just bad at tickling the animals, right? And maybe social reunion isn't that rewarding. Maybe they're fed up seeing the same rat day after day and they quite enjoyed the break. Oh, he's back again. So so we thought, well, okay, we can't rule out the possibility that we're bad ticklers, but rats are pretty good ticklers in the sense that they play together, they know how to play, and they seem to enjoy that kind of activity. So the next experiment, which was done by Hiromi Tasira in the lab, she videotaped rats and recorded their calls while they were playing, because we were very curious to know what kind of calls rats make when they're playing, because that had not been reported before in any detail. So they're just sort of doing their own thing at the moment. Okay, so they're playing, right? This is what rats like to do. And if you look carefully, I think there's one rat that instigates each of the play bouts. There we go. So they do this sort of mock aggressive behavior, pinning and pouncing on the nape of the neck and so forth. And we can videotape, slow down the film, and score these different aspects of behavior, and then ask the question, when they were pouncing on the rat's neck, were there any trill calls made? Or we can ask questions like that. Anyway, I don't think I'm going to show you the results of that because they're still preliminary, but it's clear enough from our initial that when rats are playing, they don't increase the proportion of trill calls either. So it seems that trill calls are more complicated than we imagined. We haven't actually identified any aspect of these 50 kilohertz calls that might reflect euphoria as a general measure of euphoria. Obviously, more work needs to be done. So we're far away then from deciphering the code. We don't have a rat English dictionary. If we can get towards this sort of thing, then I think ultrasonic vocalizations could be important in various ways. I think they're interesting in themselves, but they're also of interest in animal models of different sorts. The pharmaceutical industry is not doing very well at the moment for CNS drugs, and one reason people give for that is that the animal models that we have are a little bit dated, a little bit limited. If we can tap into the emotions of the animals, then maybe we can develop models that would be useful for testing antidepressant drugs or anti-anxiety drugs, or possibly analgesics as well. So I think there are implications for drug discovery. There's also work I think would be interesting to do to look at the brain mechanisms underlying these calls and try to link it with what is known already about the transmitter systems involved in motivated behavior. And we're trying to get to that question, address that question a little bit already. And there's another reason I'm interested in ultrasonic vocalizations, although this is a bit more speculative. Around the world, rats, rodents in general, are incredibly destructive for food supplies. And if the world has enough food right now, if it was properly distributed, I'm not sure that it will do for very much longer. It's a huge issue, and all around the world, rodents are killed indiscriminately in order to preserve agricultural stocks and crops and so forth. I'm sure you know that. And there are various ways to kill or immobilize rodents. Not all of them are pretty. In fact, I would say that very few of these are at all humane. You can have collateral damage. I can't imagine what it must feel like to be stuck on a glue board waiting to die or be picked off by a predator. We all make jokes about rat poison and anticoagulants and so on, but there's an excellent review article, which anybody's interested I could send you, which looks at the effects of anticoagulants and other rodenticides on humans, accidental exposure, suicide attempts, murder attempts. And the results are not pretty. So anticoagulants, for example, in high doses, the kind of doses that rodents would be exposed to, produce enormous suffering in humans. Those probably reflect about 90% of all rodenticides used around the world. But there are other things that produce phosgene gas in the intestines and other things which are quite horrific in humans. And perhaps it would be possible one day to produce ultrasonic rodent repellents or possibly attractants in order to keep animals under control with regard to agriculture in a more humane way. But we'd need to do a lot more work on that. We'd need to understand more about the meaning of these calls. So lastly, I'd just like to thank the people who did the work, Jennifer, and Tina, and Hiromi, most directly for the work that I described, but also collaborators, including Jim Gordon, the veterinary director in our building, at McGill, actually, and also the funding agency. So thank you very much.
Official thank you.
Oh, official thank you. Thank you so much.
Have you a t-shirt?
Wow. Thank you, Ingrid. Yes.
Is there evidence that the rats make certain calls in the presence of a sheep or a predator? Like, I think in terms of the predator can hear a certain frequency but not another.
Ah, so are you asking, do rats have different calls for different types of predator?
So if they, like, essentially they can communicate without alerting a predator.
Ah, I don't think they can. I think that 22 kilohertz call would be very detectable, very much audible by a cat, right? And it's a, I didn't mention this, but these alarm calls are very loud, unambiguous. There's no nuance to an alarm call. They tend to be half a second or a second long. They're very loud. And actually, I know that because this bat detector, this is something we found quite early on. What you do is you dial in the frequency that you're interested in listening to. So we dial in 50 kilohertz. And it's said that these bat detectors can detect about 4 kilohertz either side of that. However, we had rats that were a rat that was making 22 kilohertz calls, which is very far away frequency-wise, and we could pick it up perfectly, even when it was tuned at 50. What does that tell us? It tells us that these calls are very loud indeed, and we know that actually from looking at spectrograms. So I don't think there's coding as far as telling you where the predator is or what kind of predator. I doubt that. It's true that people have detected subtypes of 22 kilohertz calls, you know, a tail at one end or a fall off in frequency at the other end or something like that. So the possibility of coding is there, but most 22 kilohertz calls just look like 22 kilohertz calls, at least to my uneducated eye. Yeah. Yep.
Why the rats are used in the laboratories to check medication for us humans, among all animals? Why rats?
Why rats are not...
rabbits, for example, squirrels, or some other animals that are multiplying very fast.
Yeah. Well, rats, it depends on the scientific question, the medical question that you're interested in, right? So the animal model, we try to fit the animal, the species, to the question that we're interested in. That's part of the answer. It's also a question of economics. Rats are actually not that cheap. A rat from a supplier costs about $30, a grown-up rat, or even more. Mice are used a lot. Rats are used. There is a feeling that these some people feel that these animals are sort of lower on the scale, and so they might be their feelings may be less important to us than monkeys or chimpanzees, right? There's also the economy of keeping animals, the space required, how much they eat. So a lot turns around money, I would say. You know, research costs a lot of money, and so the cost of animals is certainly a limiting factor for many labs.
Yes, but for example, the antidepressant pills, are you checked on the rats?
Yeah.
Like how they're related to us? I mean, like Paxil was checked on rats before it was widely used in
yes.
Well,
there's a progression. So before Paxil was tested on rats, it was tested on cultured cells, right? Well, a cultured cell does not get depression, But nevertheless, you can ask useful questions from a cultured cell. What kind of molecular target does the, how does the Paxil work? What receptor is it binding to or transporter? But so in rats, we have tests for anxiety, for antidepressant effects. The rat doesn't actually need to be depressed as long as the test allows us to identify antidepressant drugs. You know, if let's say an anti, let's say it just happens that drugs that are antidepressant in humans make rats scratch their left ear. That's all we need. As long as it, the test is predictive, then we can, it can be useful. Yeah? Of course, most animal tests are a bit more than just scratching the left ear. They're based on some underlying understanding of the brain mechanisms involved in depression. But a lot of, it, although it's not necessarily pleasant to work, to do manipulations on animals, experiments on animals, nevertheless, an enormous benefit has come from research on animals overall.
Mm.
Yeah.
At the same time, you suggested, as some of the slides have suggested, there is a social context as well that is, seems to cut across individual differences. In other words, whether a mother is related to a child, whether it's a friend that they're playing with, whether it's a predator, etc., which also raises the question then, how much of this is learned behavior and how much of it is inbuilt genetic behavior?
Yes. I don't know of any work that's been done in rats on that, except that there are selectively bred lines of rats that either call a lot or call a little. In mice, there has been some studies done on whether these calls are innate or learned, a little bit of work on that that I'm aware of. To get to your question about, I think you were sort of implying that there might be some information in the calls that tells you which family you belong to, kinship, right? And certainly vocalizations in some other species are related to kinship. I don't know whether it's been demonstrated for rats. It might well be the case that they partly use these calls to show whose family they're from or who they're closely related to, but I don't know of any evidence. Okay, I'm not sure what I was referring to in that list, but there are, maybe it was the rat pups have a particular kind of call which I haven't talked about because it's not 22 and it's not 50. And rat pups make this call when they get cold or, you know, and the mother will attend to that and come and try to look after them. That might have been what I was trying to mention on the list.
Mm.
You know, I don't really know the answer to that question, whether the audible calls that rats make have what sort of meaning they have, except, of course, they tend to squeak if they're very afraid or very distressed, right? So we don't study that. In fact, you know, you have the rat has to be quite distressed, doesn't it, to make a squeaking sound that you can hear?
No, not necessarily.
Okay, go on. Yeah? Oh, all right then. Ah. I didn't know that, actually. Yeah. Yeah.
Have you, like, played their own sounds instead of, like, recording them? Have you, like, played them and seen their reactions?
Yeah, this is... So have we played the sounds back? We call that playback, right? Back to rats to see how it affects their behavior. Very few people have done that sort of experiment. It's definitely on the list of things to do. We have now a vast library. I think we've probably collected more than 100,000 calls if we add up all the experiments we've done. So, you know, we have a library of trills and a library of all sorts of things. So we'd love to do that sort of thing. It's just a question of time, money, and people. Yeah, we have the playback equipment. You have to have specialized loudspeakers that can broadcast reliably in that range. A little bit of published work has been done on that. It's been claimed, for example, that trill calls are attractive. So if you play a trill call through a loudspeaker, another rat will approach that loudspeaker. whereas flat calls, I believe, were aversive or neutral. So, but there's lots more that, that could be done in that realm, definitely. No, you see, this is a really interesting thing too, because we don't know if the rat is just mouthing off, monologuing, or whether there's a meaningful dialogue. We don't know that, and it's a technical, there's a technical reason for that. It's very tough to know which rat is calling, because the calls are such high frequency, they're very directional. You probably know that sound travels around corners if it's low frequency, but not high frequency tends to get shadowed. So if you have a microphone, let's see, here, the you can see that if a rat is turned away from the microphone, the sound might be quite soft. So you can't use intensity. Let's say you have two microphones and two rats. You can't use intensity as a measure of which rat made the call. It's not always the nearer rat that's going to make the call that's detected as louder by the microphone. It's tough because you could perhaps use the time of arrival of the sound. So if you have enough microphones and two rats, you could figure out that compare the time of arrival at each microphone, and that might be able to tell you. But these calls tend to be quite soft, and hence they're somewhat buried in the noise. I don't know. It's something that we'd like to try, but we haven't got around to doing yet. Yeah. And another thing that we don't know is whether the rats talk in phrases or whether each call is essentially separate. If a rat has just made a trill call, is he more likely to make a trill call or some other call after that? Are there particular sequences of calls that they tend to prefer? Nobody studied that. It seems to be the case in mice, that's been reported, but we don't know about rats, and rats and mice are very different.
Mm. This may be a foolish question, but have there been comparative studies done about, let's say, English rats and French rats, or British rats or rats?
Not to my knowledge. we don't even know, I don't think we even know whether there are strain differences. You may know that lab rats, there are several different strains that are commonly used of lab rats. We use the black and white ones. They see better and they're reputedly more intelligent. We don't know if there are differences in accent between black and white rats compared to albino rats, right? And what if you cross-fostered them so the black and white ones were raised by an all-white mother and vice versa? We don't know about that, but it would be cute to do. Very little has been done on wild rats versus lab rats, maybe because people, it's self-preservation perhaps. There was some early work by somebody at King's College London, one of the pioneers, actually went out and I think caught some wild rats and compared them, but nothing very systematic has been done, I would say. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you done any studies on the rats when they've been with nicotine and stuff?
No, nicotine is one drug that we haven't given to our rats to see whether that changes their calling. Yeah. One day. Yeah.
Those sounds learned, like a rat that's been raised alone, would it do the same sound?
We don't know if rats raised alone will make those sounds. I don't believe anybody has studied that. No, don't know. A rat that has been caged alone, housed alone from a fairly early age, I believe will make more calls when tickled than a normal rat. It's more, rats that live alone tend to crave the tickling more, I think. Whatever that means. Yeah, you know what? I had that as a spare slide, and I deleted it. But the mice definitely have different kinds of... Mice have subtypes of calls, too. The main difference between mice and rats, the most striking difference, is that mice lack the alarm call, that 22 kilohertz call. They just don't make it. When you look at the shape, the spectrographic shape, you know, frequency time of mouse calls, we see a lot of overlap with our calls. So there are chevrons, there's upward ramps. Don't know if mice trill. Do they trill? No. They produce quite complex calls, mice. We don't know, of course, whether they mean the same thing or not. And I very much doubt whether they can communicate with rats. But who knows? Yeah. But there's a lot of work being done in mice on ultrasonic vocalizations right now. Part of it is done by people who are interested in what changes in the brain in autism. Because, you know, social withdrawal, you can study that in different ways in mice, but one way is to look at their vocalizations when they're tested together. Yeah. But mice are very different animals. You know, they evolved in a different ecological niche, and there are people who study the behavior of mice and people who study the behavior of rats and are quite content not to switch. Plus, rats don't smell as much.
Yes, welcome, yeah. Charlie. Thank you again, Sue. I'd like to invite you all back next Sunday evening. The bigger science picture. Professor from U of T will be coming to give a talk 4 o'clock next Sunday, the 10th of February. Her name is Jennifer Carpenter. She wants to tell us how the Big Bang explains your sex life or the disconnect between science and the media. Free, everyone welcome. I'm going to put the film on. How about at 6:15? That gives you time to go get a snack. You can bring it back here, and we'll see you back here, Charlie, at 6:15.